Logos Centrifugal Podcast. I'm Chance Lunsford. I'm also Logos Centrifugal. Maybe you are too. While you're thinking about that, let me introduce today's special guest. I have with me Dr. Ed Perrin, or just Doc, as he's commonly known. And this is a man I invited on the podcast, number one, because I've gotten to know him a little bit over the course of the last few months on Twitter, and he seems like a dude with an outstanding character. And he's gotten involved with my buddies over at Ion and has contributed to IonCon. And through the course of the conversation, there's a few things that stand out. Number one, that he has a very genuine sense and desire to help other people. And then on the other hand, he's got a sense of humor, so we can not take everything seriously. And we can take the things we need to take seriously and put them in that place. And that's something that I appreciate about people in general. And as you may or may not know, I'm doing this series of episodes on war, and I wanted to bring Doc in because one of the things that we've learned about and talked about is that he helps vets coming back home to deal with some of the ramifications of having been in combat, PTSD, as many of you are probably familiar with the term, and I wanted to bring him on to talk about the costs to the people that we asked to go fight our wars and what it means for them and what it means for their families and the communities that they live in, and sort of the process of helping these guys get past some of these obstacles to their living a healthy life after combat. And so with that, welcome to the podcast, Doc. It's great to have you here. And why don't you fill in any gaps or anything else you'd like the people to know about who you are and what you do?
Sure. Thanks. Hey, you know, long time watcher, first time caller. I'm a psychologist. I do work with veterans. I don't just work with the vets who are just coming home. I work with vets from pretty much every era, even those who didn't fight during wartime. But you know what? I still like that plug about seeing vets when they come home, because, you know, every once in a while I'll get a Vietnam era vet who comes into treatment for the first time over 50 years holding some of their issues in. And it's the first time that somebody tells them, welcome home. So I think that still applies.
Wow. That's pretty intense to think about, because from my own perspective, I had a pretty rough adolescence. You know, I did a lot of things that I shouldn't have done, and I had some things happen to me in childhood, and I held on to a lot of that, and it caused a lot of behaviors in me because I hadn't taken the time and didn't really have the capacity to deal with some of the things that I was chewing on. And to think that some of these guys have been through things very much more intense than I have and have been holding on to it for decades it saddens me. But it's also uplifting to know that there's guys like you out there who are saying, hey, welcome home. You know, I'm glad you're here because I want to help you get through some of the stuff as best as I can. And I guess on that note, I wonder sort of what, is there sort of a standard process to getting to know these guys as they come into your office, or do you just sort of create a bespoke scene for these guys to step into every time you see a new guy?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, some things are standardized. Like I certainly want to assess whether or not they have thoughts of suicide. Everyone who comes in my door, I assess that. But for my vets, I like to kind of keep an open dialogue. Like, what's up? What brings you here? What I think I have a benefit as opposed to some other therapists is that, you know, I'm former Army myself, so I'll usually be decked out in like an Army lanyard or something, because vets notice things. They notice things that you don't, that most civilians won't. So they'll walk into a room and they'll suddenly have analyzed everything in my office, and they'll be like, okay, so you might get this here. Check this out and talk.
So I think I'll speak from my own experience again. I just think it's a helpful tool. But I had two different counselors in the 2 years that I was engaged with that. And the first one only lasted a matter of weeks. And it was an older lady who was getting ready to retire, and she was tired of it. And she was just sort of rather unpleasant towards me. And we didn't have rapport. We didn't have a connection on anything. She didn't understand my generation. She didn't understand who I was as a man either, it seemed to me. And then I had a night and day transition to working with a counselor who had been down some dark roads himself and then had picked himself up and then gone to school so that he could help other people do the same thing. And walking into the room was just like that with that guy. It's just like, hey, Monty, how's it going, man? It's going good, Chance. And he was very just able to deal with sort of my strong emotional outbursts and understanding where I was coming from and give me the respect as a man that I needed to have in order to make that process something that could happen. And I suppose taking sort of that idea as a guide, I wonder what are some of the things that you do to help these guys feel comfortable with you to build rapport so that you can get past the pleasantries or the initial experience into dealing with some of the more things that are going to be very personal and painful to bring out of them and into the open?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's an awesome start to this conversation. And I'm also really glad that you're kind of leading with this, because fit is very important with therapy. And I'm sure that older therapist you saw was a great clinician and probably treated people extremely well who were a good fit. But one thing that clients need to understand, if you are engaging in therapeutic services, you have every right to go, not you, not feeling it. You can fire your therapist. It's okay. They're probably feeling it too. She was probably going, I don't get this kid. What am I going to do with him? So long as you don't give up, like you tried again, you found a great fit. That's what I want to see. If someone fires me, you get a little bit of the sting to the ego, but for the most part, you're like, yeah, you know what? Might not have been the best fit. But what I like to do, I have a little bit of an ego. I think I'm pretty good. I mostly just accept whatever they bring to the table. I think with vets especially, by the time they're walking in, they may have blown up their issues or their events or what they've done. Some things may be really horrific. In wartime, there are experiences of soldiers where they have to kill children. And that I've heard various stories and various conflicts and various engagements where it was them or me or them or my unit, them or my operating base. And they hold on to this because who am I going to tell that I killed a kid? And for the most part, it's a lot less than that. Maybe it was just something they didn't do or something that happened to them, but in their mind, it's the worst thing ever. And if anyone heard it, they would judge me. They would judge me or they would consider me less than. And I don't believe that. In fact, my bar is actually, I've heard some things even worse than child killing. I won't talk about it because quite frankly, that's really bad. And since my bar is higher, they'll come in and they'll let it out and I'll hold it. I'll say, yeah, that's tough. Not my bar though. My bar is actually quite evil. Some of the things that I've worked with. So, I could be like, yeah, let's work with that. And my nonverbals, my body language, I'll be like, they can kind of pick up, wow, he's not going to judge me for this. And I'll carry it with them. Some of these things are horrible. And even if it was in that moment, in that moment, it kind of needed to be done. And our past doesn't define us. We can look at that as, hey, that wasn't okay for this and that reason. What did you learn from that? And how does that inform you on who you are today? Do you go outside and shoot children? No, of course not. Well, you've learned something that's really important. And like, what do you do now? Well, now I donate to Toys for Tots all the time. I've sponsored kids in third world countries, or I'm engaged in the Big Brother, Big Sister program. So this horrible thing that happened to you has actually influenced you to become a better, more caring, more giving human being. But that's who you are today. What's more important is right here and right now. And some of them, they don't look at it that way. They say no, this thing that I had to do that maybe I was ordered to do makes me a bad person. I don't know if that answered the question.
No, it does. And it's when I have these kinds of conversations, I can't help but sort of relate it to my own experiences because, you know, I wasn't asked by anybody to go do the dark things I did. I just did them. And I had some stuff come my way that I didn't ask for either. And that had a lot to do with why I went the way I did. But at the same time, you know, it took me a lot of unpacking to stop defining myself by the worst things that I have done in my life. And, one of the things I saw, because I was involved in both one-on-one counseling and then in group counseling, is that there's also the flip side of that coin, which is that sometimes you've done something that's pretty awful. And instead of really truly facing that and dealing with that, you sort of pretend that that didn't happen. And then you say, I'm defining myself by who I am right now, but I haven't addressed, or I'm not going to address these things that I've done. But what you find, and I saw this time and again in the group counseling, is the guys who made that choice to just sort of cloister themselves off from the things that they had done or had been through that had come to them even, is that you don't really deal with the issue, and then it's still just there lingering, and it brings stuff out of you that maybe you're not even noticing, or you don't understand that that's the cause of what's happening, but it is. And until you deal with that, you're not going to be able to walk away from certain behaviors or release certain thought patterns, and it's going to continue to occur. And I guess I wonder, look, I've done crime and I've seen violence and I've seen some pretty terrible things, but I've never killed anybody. Mm-hmm. The people that I know who have, especially outside of a war situation, it ravages their soul, for lack of a better way. You know, you end somebody's life and then it tears you up. And I think it is a little bit different with soldiers because it's war and they're asked to, and the other person's got the gun pointed at you often, or at least the metaphorical gun. It might not be a gun, but whatever the situation is, your life's on the line, and it's always on the line in a certain sense in those situations. And I guess taking that perspective, I wonder, sort of, how do you help these guys? Because you talked about, okay, you're not defining yourself by your worst experience, but that's a lot easier to say than it is to actually help somebody guide somebody through the steps to letting go of that perspective, and then giving them the tools to say, this is going to fire up inside of you again. It's not like you step out of this office and you have a breakthrough and then it goes away forever. You're going to have to continue to deal with this. And I guess I wonder how you sort of guide these guys down the different steps that they need to take, and then arm them with the tools they need to continue to be able to do that within themselves when they're not in your presence, when they're outside of the sort of therapy environment.
Well, I first want to clarify, there is a difference between killing and murder. I don't think a lot of people make that separation. I have killed, therefore I am a murderer. That's an identity. That's something that they've held on to which, you know, I might playfully go, oh yeah, you murder anybody recently? You're going to go out, you're going to leave my office and murder a few people? No, of course not. Well, then you're not a murderer. That point about defining yourself by what you've done, you know, that anyone, you know, we're focusing on killing, which can be an aspect of military service. It's a lot broader than that. What can be traumatic, but, let's say for sake of example, it was a killing, that event is still going to be an up. Everyone remembers a critical point in your life. Everyone remembers their ups or their down, their extreme ups or their extreme downs. That's probably still going to be an extreme impactful memory, but we change the relationship with the event. One thing that we can't change, hey, you killed. You talk about, I'm going to use you as an example, because this way I'm not going to be making some stuff up as I go along. You say that you've done crimes, you've done some pretty brutal stuff. That's history. You can't change history. That happened. You did it. But what you can change is your relationship with it. And this is what I try to break down with my veterans. What did you learn from that experience? What did that connect you with? In the moment, maybe it was out of necessity, or it was a way that you're coping with some other shit in your life. Do you curse on
this? You're good to go. Hey, free for all.
Free for all. Awesome. But what we find, this is actually what my research is on, is that these critical events help us identify what's really important, that we might not have ever noticed if it never happened to us or if we didn't. That's not to say, hey, we're better people because we XYZ, but because XYZ, we were able to take a really close look at ourselves and say, that's not okay. In fact, because I did that, or we've used killing as an example, I now understand the value of human life. So now that I know the value of human life, I'm going to live my life according to that. And you find people who have these really profound breakthroughs where they get really involved. Veterans, I think, are especially good at looking out for other veterans. In the VA system, we have what we call peer support specialists. They're people who maybe they struggled with addiction, they cleaned themselves up, and now they dedicate their lives to helping other people who are in that journey of addiction. It's like, I'm not any different from you. I'm just a little bit further down the road. So I can look back and say, hey, maybe you can take a few steps here. They get really involved because this is what's important. What's important is getting people, what's important to you is it's different from what's important to me, because I've wrestled with my own battles. I found what I valued. You are probably living your life differently now than when you were younger. And I bet a lot of what you do is informed from those lessons that you learn from struggling with a tougher time.
Absolutely. In fact, a lot of what I teach and help people with, and a great deal of my sort of public mission is to say, I've been to these places and I've done these things. And then I was honest about it with myself. I turned around and I looked at the things that I'd done and I said, okay, I did those things. And yeah, they were shitty. And I hurt people and I hurt myself and I broke trust and I, you know, and all those things that can weigh very heavily upon a person, especially if you haven't sort of just aligned yourself with that way of life, because that's possible. And you see that happen, but I'm not an evil man. And I never wanted to be, even though I was veering in that direction. And so I've, this is one of the things I wanted to ask you about tying into this is, you have who you are in the moment and you have what you've done in the past. And like you said, you need to change your relationship with the things that are not working for you in here and in here, so that you can then be able to process those things in a way that doesn't limit your capacity to do the kind of things that you want to do right now. And one of the great tools that I have found to be able to do that is storytelling. What is your life story? And, you know, that's a phrase that gets thrown around a lot, but the reality is that we think of our lives in a story and we're supposed to be the hero of our own stories. And when you're not the hero of your own story, that's a traumatic life to live every day, that you're the villain in your own life story. And I guess I wonder how overtly you use the tools of storytelling or helping guys develop stories about themselves and about their experiences as a tool to help them do exactly what you talked about, which is sort of adjust their relationship with their memories and their experiences in a way that stops holding them back.
Mm-hmm. Actually, I've been known to do that very overtly. Part of my dissertation, I looked at, I'm blanking on his name, Dan McAdams. He does the, he's one of the narrative therapists, or he came up with a life story approach to therapy, because he looks at it similar to what we were talking about. He called it the nadir experience, which is the low, the bad thing that happened. It could be somebody betrayed you, or someone passed away, or you witnessed something horrific or did something horrific. Then there's the redemption, which is, you know, what did I do to get out of that? And I like to help people build their redemption narrative, because they'll come to me and they'll say, hey, doc, you know, this thing happened 6 years ago and I've never been able to pull myself out. And I'll go, not at all. And it's like, well, you know, I've done this and that. They go, okay, so you're coming out of it. You're starting your redemption story. What's next? I was like, well, you know, I want to go to college, or, you know, I want to start opening up to more people. I want to develop a new relationship with my children, because I've been isolated or withdrawn, and I haven't taught my kids the fundamental, like, father-son stuff yet. And so that's going to be your redemption narrative. Like, let's write that story, and we'll work together on what that would look like. It might be, I'm going to go home and I'm going to play catch with my boy. And they'll come in a week later and they'll say, we'll talk about that. And, you know, how fun of a therapeutic intervention is, go home and play catch with your son. Okay, I'll try it. Come on. I really connected with something meaningful. Being a dad is meaningful. People don't want to just be a dad. They want to be a good dad. That's part of their redemption narrative.
So that touches upon something that, you know, because you mentioned before, well, you know, it's not just killing that is the traumatic experiences that these guys have. And a lot of the traumatic experiences, I'm sure, are not just out there, but when you come home and your relationships mm-hmm. suffer and your work prospects suffer because you have this stuff going on inside of you that's very hard to deal with. And sure, maybe they shut down tight, but it's not just like you grab one experience and you hold on tight and it doesn't affect anything else. It's sort of like the fascia system, where if you have a pinch in an area, it contracts the whole system and makes it function in a way that's suboptimal. And I guess, I wanted to kind of get into maybe a few of the other ways that you see are commonalities between guys who are dealing with traumatic stuff, whether it's relationships or what are some of the other ways you see that the problems associated with traumatic events manifest in their lives?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I believe we've all, I think that PTSD, I want to throw the disorder out for a second, but trauma that every single human being has experienced. Trauma or something traumatic. And I think that can be a very universal thing. You know, maybe objectively we can't compare our traumas with other people, but to us subjectively, it completely shattered our lives. I joke, but if the worst thing that ever happened to you is that you stubbed your toe, your subjective experience of that stubbed toe would be the worst thing that's ever happened. Oh my gosh. So how we come to terms with that can be very universal, because it can come out, as you said, I don't remember the exact words you used, but come out sideways. So this is my trauma. I'm keeping it to myself. I use isolation as an example. I'm not going to leave my house. Well, that's not living. It's not thriving. I feel like I'm going off topic a little bit. I think one of the more universal components is learning to thrive, learning to not let these things shackle you. Yes, the events happen. We can sort of rearrange what it means. Some of it might not even be accurate. For example, the person who stubbed your toe, the worst thing ever. Is that the worst thing ever? Let's look at that. They might go, okay, you know, now that I look at it, it was awful that it happened, but now I know what's important, like avoiding that end table in the middle of the night. So what are you going to do now? Well, now I'm going to try going further out. Maybe I'm going to leave my house. Maybe I'm going to explore. Maybe someday I'll be willing to, with enough work, I can walk by other tables again. I think the universal components are usually around adequacy and inadequacy. This wrestling with, I'm good enough, I'm not good enough, I'll never be good enough, or I'm afraid that if people knew this about me, they wouldn't think that I'm good enough. Potency and impotency, power and powerlessness, a feeling of I can control my life versus I have no control over my life. Somebody who stays in their home all day, they have complete control over their environment. You walk out the front door, you have no control over your environment. That can be really scary. We can navigate that even with relationships, trust, right? We can we could have a best friend for 35 years and then they could completely stab you in the back. That makes you wrestle with that. Am I powerful enough or do I have no power? And I think at the end of the day, the third universal component, which is, I would say even underpins the other two, is that fear of abandonment. If I'm not powerful enough, I'm not worthy. People will leave me or people will hate me or I will be abandoned. If I'm not good enough, no one will love me and no one will be with me. And I say this a lot, that the fear of abandonment is worse than actual abandonment, because we've all been abandoned tons of times in our lives and we bounce back and we're thrilled. But if there's something we care about or something we are afraid of losing, we live that every second and every moment of our day. Regardless of what our traumatic experience was, it in some way, shape, or form affects our adequacy, our power, or our fear of abandonment.
You know, that's a very important point. And I think sometimes people, they maybe fail to understand just how big of a factor fear is. In fact, to me, fear is often the true wound. I mean, you might get stabbed literally with a knife in a certain situation. Mm-hmm. And you might've been in that situation 1,000 times. And then the one time you get stabbed, the 999 other times go right out the window because you got stabbed. And now there's that fear. And that fear is a sort of a psychic wound that just is ever present. And if you ever get near a situation that is similar to it or has similar aspects, well, you're getting stabbed again. You're getting stabbed over and over and over again. And that kind of, like an easy example for maybe people who are listening, and you use the stub toe experience, but let's just say maybe you slip and fall and you hit your knee really hard because it's icy outside. Well, if you don't take the time to really process that and be okay with it, then every time it's snowy outside or cold even, or there's uncertain footing, then you're reliving that experience. And then maybe you avoid situations like that. I'm not going outside today because it's snowy. Well, but what about your friends who you used to go skiing or snowshoeing with? Well, I can't go with them anymore. So maybe we're not as close anymore. And then that hurts. And then you are actually creating the conditions for that abandonment to occur. And so that fear becomes a self-perpetuating cycle and a self-fulfilling prophecy. And then the sort of outside effects or the perimeter effects of that fear come in and start manifesting themselves. And it's just like this big tangle, this big mess. And so I guess because you've got guys who are coming right back and then you've got guys who have been outside of combat for decades. And then you've got people who maybe haven't even been in combat, but they've seen damage come to friends or they thought, well, my actions contributed to certain things. And that's causing me distress that I don't know how to properly process. And I'm wondering just maybe what are some of the tools that you use to help? Because, you know, obviously soldiers are tough guys and they are in a real sense. They're, you know, they're fit and they're strong and they do hard things, but then they also are expected to sort of have that disciplined stoic persona about them a lot of times, or even just maybe they feel like they needed to have that because that's sort of the public expectation. And I guess I'm just curious some of the tools or some of the steps you take to help bring the fear up and then to be honest and deal with it in a space that's safe so that they can then take that with them and go out and have the inner courage to face that in the world. So, you know, kind of stepping outside of the controlled home and into the chaotic world and still being able to deal with that, even though they've got all this extra input that's might be confusing or overwhelming at first.
Well, I do exactly what you just said, is to really explore what that fear is. And separation from the fear and the actual event, I think what you touched upon with your ICE example is the confusing probability with likelihood. Yeah, is it probable that you're going to slip on the ice and hit your knee again? Yeah. Is it likely? Not if you take reasonable steps to keep yourself safe. And I laugh about this a lot when I'm on Twitter, because, you know, being in self-help Twitter and transformation Twitter is great, but working with veterans is almost the exact opposite. Because self-help transformation Twitter is work harder, do more, exercise. And the vets come in, it's like, all I do is work and exercise. And it's like, okay, we actually kind of need to cut that back a little bit. Like, what aren't you doing? And a lot of it is giving yourself some slack, because they are acutely aware of things that could go wrong. They were trained to anticipate things that can go wrong to keep themselves and the person to their left and the right safe. So, I made this joke on my Aeon Con presentation that they won't go into a Walmart. Veterans hate Walmart. I make fun of Walmart a lot, but this is a genuine thing. If you talk to vets, they will they know all of the strategies. Go at 2 a.m. Nobody's there. Park by the garden entrance so that you can get in what you need. And typically the garden checkout counter, there are fewer checkout counters, but nobody uses them. So even though they'll go their grocery shopping, they'll check out in the garden section so they'll have less chance of someone in front of them or behind them, and they'll get in their car and they can drive away. In the extreme example, they won't go inside the Walmart. Maybe they'll let their wife go in and go shopping because something bad can happen. And I always laugh because it's some part of them knows it's safe enough to let their wife go in, but they themselves won't, for fear of just being overwhelmed by all the possible things that could go wrong, all the chances of being attacked. And I'm not saying that Walmart will never be the victim of a terrorist attack. I think that in some ways Walmart is terrorism, but it hasn't happened. And it probably won't. And to be honest, a lot of vets, if they were in a Walmart that suddenly was attacked, they would very likely know exactly what to do. They would probably be better prepared than everybody else there. But it can be overwhelming. So to answer your question, some of the ways that I make space to talk about these things is by exploring it. They'll say, hey, I can't go into Walmart because XYZ will happen. And I'll be like, let's really explore that thought process. And it could take one session, it can take four sessions. But eventually they're going to get to the point of saying, well, I mean, if my neighbor can go into Walmart and he's overweight and clueless and oblivious to everything, then you know what? Gosh darn it, maybe I can too. And we'll create a plan. What to do. Start with maybe 5 minutes, go in, get a pack of gum, come out, and you go, okay, I survived that. Maybe it'll be more likely I can do that again. And some people get it like that. Sometimes it takes a lot longer. It just really depends on what your issue is.
A little bit of immersion therapy there.
Oh, I'm a huge fan of it. Marines like me because Marines are like, let me do the scariest fucking thing I can do right now. I'll be like, oh, okay, let's maybe not do the scariest thing, but we'll push ourselves. Other vets hate me. It's like, that's uncomfortable. Why are you making me do that? Because it's uncomfortable. That's where we're going to grow.
There's a counterpoint to what you were talking about just now, because the Walmart conversation was framed in a way where a guy might be frightened about or concerned about or have a fear about what's going to happen around them. Mm-hmm. But there's another concern, and this is something that I speak from experience with, as I was sort of getting a hold on the way that I behave in public settings and stuff, is you might be afraid of how you are going to act. It might not be that it's threats that you're worried about. It's being worried that you are the threat. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're trained to be an aggressor, or you've lived as a predator, or if you've lived as a person who, as my dad used to put it, I'd just as soon fight you as look at you. but you don't necessarily want to be living that way, but you know you have that short trigger. You know you have those things that when you get, you know, sensory overload or something, that you have a tendency to lash out. Then going into a Walmart can be a scary thing too, because you say to yourself, I don't want to cause any further harm to anybody, but I know about myself that when I'm in these situations, I do these kinds of things. And so I guess I wonder how often you see that, and maybe if it's different in the way that you might deal with someone on that end of the spectrum versus the other.
Yeah, no, that's actually very common. I know people in and out of the military who are like that. I actually have a friend of mine. He was a really good friend of mine. And because of the way he was raised, like his dad was a multiple martial artist, had a gang history, and he raised his son to be the toughest guy in the room. And he knows that he can go from 0 to 100 like that. And it worried him, and it worried his girlfriend at the time. He never served in the military. That was just his background. So it could happen to anyone. I think it is different, but I also want to look at the two different mechanisms in play, one of which is that internalized shame. There's something wrong with me. I am bad. I can't go into a public place, or the bad man will do bad things, which I'd want to correct. I'd want to explore that and really understand things. Because right, that I can never get on board with that, because if you're thinking that way, then you must have a moral compass. You have to understand the value of safety or of other people's freedom. And people who genuinely don't care about that, those are the evil people. They're the ones, yeah, I don't care about going out. I'll hurt whoever I see, whatever. That's who I am. Yeah, that's a real problem. The other component, I would say, is physiological. The physiological response of anger, and even the physiological response of PTSD, is very real. Even if the scenario is inaccurate, you know, somebody grabs the last thing at the last bag of chocolates at Walmart, and you get angry and you knock that guy out. Your interpretation of that scenario might be, you know, he's a threat, or he's an asshole, he did that on purpose just to spite me. The assessment may be very inaccurate. The assessment may even be it might have jumped a few steps to get there. He could have just wanted that candy bar. I had no idea you were there. A likely scenario, it was not remotely malicious. But the physiological response is very real. That 0 to 100 is felt in the whole body. You get into fight or flight mode. And for a lot of people, they might even know this isn't intentional, but my body temperature is going up, my heart rate is faster, I'm clenching my teeth and my fists. Crap, I'm escalating, now I gotta swing. I call that a miscalibration of the central nervous system. We have the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system, one that gets us ready to fight and move, and the other one calms us down. This one is a lot more developed than this one. We can work on that. There are a lot of exercises. There are a lot of people on Twitter who talk about mindfulness and meditation and self-reflection, which are ways to on purpose activate that parasympathetic nervous system to calm down, to create, to lower that heart rate. Like a bodybuilder, how do you lift heavier weights? You do reps. You start with lighter weights and you move up. You don't bench press for the first time 300 pounds. You're going to hurt yourself. So, you know, but with practice and with training and with putting more plates on over time, you're going to be able to lift heavy. That's the same way with training or calibrating your central nervous system. So that's the two hand thing. One addressed the very real physiological thing that is not made up at all. And the other one, which is to train that, maybe that address that self-stigma that I'm evil and I'm bad, but also to maybe check the facts a little bit. Does this person hate you and that's why he got those candy bars? I play a game Road rage is a pretty common one that I think most people can relate with, right?
Fuck you, I'll destroy you!
Yeah, exactly. I don't have road rage because I play a game and I like to share people my road rage game. I try to think of the funniest reason possible that other person cut me off or did a double lane change or something. So I'd say, oh, you know what? He's in the process of peeing his pants. He has to go to the bathroom so bad that, you know, he's pulling to that gas station. It's because he's prairie dogging a little bit and he doesn't see the other cars because he has to go. And then I'm laughing at him. And because I'm laughing at him, I'm not screaming and smashing my fists against the dashboard of my car. So there are fun games that you can play to trick that central nervous system.
Man, it's great that you mentioned that because humor for me has literally been a lifesaver. It's something, for example, and this is just a small deal, but it's illustrative because many people have had a similar experience. I was in the liquor store getting a bottle of wine for my wife the other day. Mm-hmm. And I decided to go sober this whole year with the exception of some days I've set aside for specific reasons on those days to not be, but I was there and I was just getting some wine and there was a long line and it was sort of backed up between two aisles of wine. And I was just approaching the line casually. And then this old lady and her husband sneak around the line and hurriedly sort of shuffle up in front of me to get into the line. And I was one step away and they just sort of like get in there. And at first, you know, I had that reaction that a lot of people would have where I was like, fuck you, you know, like, yeah. Who raised you? You know, you're 60 years old, you're butting in line. You don't have the 5 seconds to just observe common courtesy. But then I started just laughing about it and imagining like, why would they be like that? And then I started sort of observing them and telling myself a funny story about what was going on. Yeah. And there's a common refrain, and I think it's very much true almost across the board. I wouldn't say it's universal, but if somebody doesn't have a sense of humor, they're not to be trusted. Mm-hmm. And well, maybe not a sense of humor, but some way of de-escalating the negativity within them.
It's not fun to be around. Mental health wise, I say that if you can make a joke about it, you have power over your situation. But if you can't joke about it, your situation has power over you. Mm. My dad's a great example of that. He battled cancer. He was one of the lucky ones. He pulled through. And I truly believe it's because he had a sense of humor that he recovered. This man would just crack you up. He would walk into his radiation appointment and go, I'm here for my tanning. He was great. And, you know, anytime you asked him how he was doing, he's like, oh man, I've lost 40 pounds on the chemo diet. And he's like, yeah, I'm almost down to my college weight. Like he would just joke about it. These terrible, horrible things, the weight loss and chemo is awful. And you would see him grinning ear to ear, cracking jokes about his own experience. I think that yes, it's an ego defense. Yes, it's a way to, you know, cover up some unwanted feelings. But in the grand scheme of things, if we rank up all of the ways to defend, maybe splitting on one end and humor is going to be the other end. It's the most mature form of ego defense. If you're going to have one, have a sense of humor.
Yeah, you know, just sort of tangentially. The deeper sort of you've been in the pit of despair, mm-hmm. if you've made it out, boy, your sense of humor is whack. There's things I laugh about that my wife just looks at me and she's like, what is wrong with you? It's like, well, I have some reactions to some of this stuff. And the only thing I know how to do is to laugh about it because that frees me from the other reactions that I might have. And, over time, of course, you can maybe develop a higher level of emotional maturity and be able to just look at a thing and go, well, that's a thing. Mm-hmm. But even then I would rather be laughing about it than to be mature about it, to be frank, because that's how I like to live my life. I like to have a smile on my face. I like to laugh about it. And for that reason, I make friends easily with cops and with soldiers because the gallows humor in those two groups is just, even sometimes I, twisted as I am, I'm just like, oh my God.
I was actually,
I can't believe you said that.
Get along with vets because they have dark senses of humor.
Okay, so look, recentering here. I told you before we started the podcast that I wanted this to have a lot of heart. And we've talked about some of these things that are commonly that people who have been through traumatic experiences, soldiers in particular, in the frame of this conversation, have to deal with. And you know, you don't realize that the guy with the tattoo on his arm, and you go, okay, well, that's a soldier. You know, I can see the Marine logo right there. But you don't realize that he's carrying around all this weight. And all these traumas and all these hitches and all these triggers and stuff. He's just a guy, and you're like, there's a guy. But these are the people that we ask to go do things that are often horrific. And even if they aren't, they're placed in a situation where they have to be on red alert all the time, or at least like orange alert. You know, you always got to be wary. You always got to be paying attention. And it's taxing on the nervous system. It's taxing on the psyche. It's taxing on the relationship for the people who then have to be around you afterwards. Even in my experience, which is not so extreme, I'm on alert a lot because I know how people can be, because I was one of them and I was around them and I've seen things. And it's like, I know how people can be, and I'm paying attention. And it's taken me 10 years of work to go from like minimum orange alert to like, I can be down here at light yellow, maybe sometimes, but you know, I'm usually like, okay, I need to be paying attention. And that's just one example. There's so many of these things that we've talked about and many that we haven't. And the reason that I wanted to kind of hit these things like this is just to sort of illustrate that there are millions of guys and women too, more recently, that and even sort of the medical staff that have helped these guys in these situations. I mean, men or women, you see something, you see traumatic, you know, you see the aftermath of a IED, for example. You might not have been the one to be blown up, but if you see the guy who comes in and he's gore and he's sliced up and he's unconscious and you have to do everything that's medically possible to save the guy, and he just barely comes through and he wakes up and he's all messed up, mm-hmm. That's traumatic for the people who are, yeah. You know, for the medical staff too.
Yeah, the medical staff.
And so what I'm trying to get at with all of this is that there are millions of people walking around with some or all or more of the things that we've talked about tonight. And it often, in my experience, people don't really understand that that's the case, or understand how heavy those weights can be. Because if you don't have those triggers, if you don't have those switches to be flipped, if you haven't seen those kinds of things, you really can't place yourself inside of the shoes of someone who has. You can do your best to be understanding and compassionate and everything, but if you haven't seen somebody get, like if you haven't seen your brother get blown up next to you or shot or contributed to something that ended in catastrophe, there's really no way for you to be able to understand it in anything close to the same kind of way. But what I want to know from you, because this is what you do, is how can, because not everybody's a therapist. Not everybody's even been to that, you know, anywhere close to that level of extremity. But how can the people walking about who realize that their friends or their neighbors or their coworkers with some of these guys and some of these women who have been through these things, what can they do in their relationships to help foster some healing, to help foster some trust, to help remind our soldiers and frankly, other people who have been through traumatic stuff that, hey, it's okay for you to be here. You're a welcome and wanted member of the community. You're a welcome and wanted member of my life. I'm your friend. I'm your family member. I'm your spouse. And I want for you to feel okay around me and to understand that I want you here. What can people do on the other side of the end to help facilitate those kinds of things?
Well, I'm pretty sure if you ask that question to most veterans, they'd say, you don't have to do anything for me, just you stop being such a soup sandwich, because they don't like civilians. No, I'm teasing. You don't have to understand the vets. In fact, you won't, but you can try. I think something you and I are guilty of is a majority of our conversation has been about some of the forms of violence that soldiers do, but that's actually one of the most rare occurrences of PTSD. It happens. I don't want to say, you know, that, oh, soldiers are cool killing all the time, but that's usually not the one that messes them up. World War I's a really good example of this. Before there was PTSD, it was called shell shock, and it wasn't the act of war so much as you were in the trenches and you were hearing mortars all day. You were hearing a mortar. You never knew when the next one was going to be yours. So even if you never fired a shot, even if you didn't watch your best friend get blown up, you lived on that constant state of orange, red, and that completely can shake your central nervous system. I think some of the bigger, the more common ones can even just be betrayals. And to understand that if somebody is a soldier is suffering, it's not because he's just killed a whole bunch of people and feels bad about it. It could be anything under the sun. And that they also deserve acceptance and, I think probably acceptance more than anything else. It's like, hey, you know, you have your life, I have mine, but you know, we're good. A lot of vets don't even like being thanked. Sometimes that thank you for your service. There are tons of vets that can't stand that. It bothers them. So maybe even be aware and conscientious about what you say to them. For Vietnam vets, I always say welcome home. For our younger guys and gals, if I say anything at all, it would be thank you for your willingness to serve. Because for many of them, you know, they were betrayed by a fellow soldier or a superior officer. Military sexual trauma is a big one. And it's not just the girls out there. There are just as many guys who are sexually assaulted in the military. There are a lot more men in the military, so the percentages are different, but there are just as many men who present with military sexual trauma as women, and it affects them differently. It's, you know, power and powerlessness, adequacy and inadequacy. These things go like, what happened? You know, people held me down or attacked me. To where they look back at their military service as terrible. I don't trust them. They betrayed me. They trained me this entire time to be willing to jump on a grenade for the person next to me, but the person next to me attacked me. It can really mess with how you trust, with how safe you feel around other people. Because if your brother in arms could attack you, then anyone could. I can't trust anybody. World's not safe out there. So what we can do is not jump to conclusions. We don't know what it is that they went through. We don't know what it is that they're struggling with when they come back. It could be something just like, I wasn't there for my kid's first steps. Like, I mean, these important milestones, and I feel guilty about it. Whatever it might be, don't assume. Just show acceptance and try not to make a big deal out of things. They get uncomfortable. They get uncomfortable if you're uncomfortable. I don't know if that answered your question, but I think for a common person, if you see some vets, buy them breakfast. Don't say a word, just buy them breakfast. That way you get to keep their distance, but they'll feel appreciated. Buy them a beer. Things of that nature. I don't know. Those are the recommendations I'd give.
That's an important point. You did say that we're we're both guilty of sort of focusing on that. And obviously from the outside, that's how a lot of people view soldiery, but I think it's worth noting that, just a second, man.
Understood.
People worried about kids locking themselves in rooms, but it's just this kid. Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, that the shell shock, the battle fatigue, the PTSD, the idea that you're redlining all the time, and that has a physiological rewiring that occurs when you're there for that long, and people's tolerances are different, and sometimes all it takes is one traumatic moment to permanently rewire the way that a person looks at the world, and sometimes it takes a long time, but if you're there for extended periods of time, it can have very drastic effects. And I really liked one of the things that you talked about, which is, you know, don't be the corny guy who goes up and thank you for your service. Although maybe some of them like it, a lot of them don't. And I've known a bunch of guys who say, don't say that to me. I don't want to hear that. You know, you don't know anything about my service. Don't thank me for anything that you don't have any idea what you're talking about. But the idea of just like, hey man, you know, I appreciate you as a person and let me buy you a beer. I think that holds true for just about everybody out there. And that kind of ties into one of the things I think you were getting at, and I want to be sure that we're a little explicit about, is a soldier is just a person. They might have had some different experiences than, say, the general populace or whatever, but they're just, like I talked about before, how the guy with the Marine tattoo that you see, you look at him as just a guy sometimes, but then other times you're like, oh, you're a soldier? Well, who'd you kill? You know, but the reality is he's just a guy. He is just that guy. He's just the guy at Walmart.
I drove trucks. What the hell, man?
Yeah. And to, you know, you wouldn't, like, for example, if somebody had overdosed on drugs or something and then they made it back, you know, you wouldn't be like, dude, like, how many times did you overdose? And have you ever known anybody who died because of drugs? And what was, or like people who go to prison, like, bro, what was prison like? And, you know, there's that corny version. And then there's just the, like, this is just a dude who's trying to live his life. And you want to, like, try to bring up the worst things that they've dealt with. And just like in a casual conversation. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe my point is just, you wouldn't treat anybody else that way. So why would you treat a soldier that way? And I think that's a pretty important point. Now, we've been going for about an hour right now,
mm-hmm.
and we've touched on quite a few things, and I wonder, are there things that you feel like need to be said or that you would like to cover that we haven't gotten to yet?
I think that we touched upon perhaps the most important components, which I think is how to show compassion in our own way. I mentioned this briefly before we started, that, you know, veterans from the different generations, they're all different. Desert Shield are different from Desert Storm. People who served in the 80s during the, you know, I've known tons of people who served during a lot of that USA, USSR tension, where there wasn't, combat per se, like not in a modern army versus a modern army, but the threat was there. And certainly if you weren't paying attention, you could be thrown into the back of a trunk and driven somewhere. And our boys in Vietnam, you know, they were treated a lot differently than how we are now. I think that we're now addressing some of the things that needed to be addressed over 50 years ago. We're not perfect, but we're doing a lot better. If there is one thing that I'd like to talk about from that range of how Vietnam vets are treated and how we are treated is veterans, so like services for veterans. When you got out of Vietnam, you'd be lucky if they gave you a textbook on small business management, pat you on the back and say, thanks for surviving. And that's it. But now there are so many things that are available for veterans, and regardless of when you served, not just in mental health care, but you know, if you're struggling with addiction, there are excellent services. Homelessness, excellent services. It's a different world, and I hear this from the Vietnam guys the most. They come in and they love the VA. They get this. They have this bad taste in their mouth from how it was even just 20, 30 years ago. But like if you had a bad experience and you say, screw it, I'm never going to go there again, like try it again, see what you could get. You might be surprised at the difference, what it's like now and, what the VA might be able to do for you. It's night and day. It really is.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that one of the things that you want to make sure is expressed is that there are options out there to help our vets mm-hmm. do what they need and want to do, whether it's help with school or business or mental health or physical health, that it's a lot more responsive than it might have been in, say, the Vietnam generation.
Yeah. And I, and for those of you watching who aren't vets, maybe a lot of you young bucks who have found their way on transformation self-help Twitter because you want to know how to be an adult in this world. Just because we've been talking about the dark side of military service doesn't mean that it's a terrible option. I served. It was probably one of the best times of my life. Yes, it was rough. It was by no means easy. It was not puppies and rainbows. But being able to look back at it from that view of 30,000 feet, it was an incredible experience. It can be very rewarding. I know some people who joined there. It doesn't really matter why you join. I know people, their lives were worse before, like they joined the military to escape chaos and violence. It's funny to imagine someone joining the military to slow down. But it could be great opportunities, college. I would not have, I joined out of college and, you know, if it wasn't for that, I wouldn't have gotten into graduate school. The military service is awesome. Overwhelmingly people, if you ask vets, they will say it was the most meaningful thing that they've ever done. So just because we talk about the dark things that can happen doesn't mean that military service is bad. It's actually incredible. There's risk. You sign away a lot of your rights as an American citizen up to and including your life. I actually endorse it. I think people should join the military. They don't have to grab a rifle. They don't have to be infantry. It's people have to, oh, I'm a man. I have to be infantry. No. What do you want to do in the civilian sector? Do you want to work with cars, computers? Do you want to be on the business side? Guess what? There's a military equivalent for that. And they'll pay you to learn it. And we take care of you when you get out.
You know, I have an uncle who was kind of a fuck up as a young man. And my grandparents told him, look, you can join the military, you can get out, and you can stay out. And he joined the Air Force, and he was a mess when he went in. And when he came out, he wasn't a perfect man or anything, but he gained skill in electronics and technical IT stuff, and that's been he's been gainfully employed in IT since he got out of the Air Force. And he's made a good living, and he's built a life for himself. And, I mean, he's still... You know, he's still Uncle Jim and everything, but he's able to make a life for himself, and he's a good dude, and he learned a lot. And just as a kind of a funny side note, I asked him one time, was it hard to get through basic training? He's like, No, as long as you're willing to give up a little sleep and run 2 miles, it wasn't that bad.
Yeah, in many ways, it's the easiest job you can ever have. They tell you what to wear, when to be there, and where to go. And so long as you do that, bam, you're not going to get fired.
Okay, so, you know, sort of touching on, and I'm glad that you plugged it in the way that you did, because we did focus on a lot of the negatives. And I did that because I wanted people to understand the reality of that, that is a reality, that these guys, a lot of them deal with some really harsh stuff, and it's hard to get over, and it's hard to be the person who carries those things around. But so I'm glad that you touched upon the positive aspects, at least there a little bit at the end. But I do want
vets, you're going to see them decked out in their branch or their unit, or they're proud. They loved what they did.
And I don't think you could say that about a great many careers, or even just you couldn't take a period of 5 years of your life and be like, that's the time when I was the man and all the men were around me and I had a great time and I learned what I needed to learn and I developed some self-respect and I took that with me and made something of myself. And that's an important point. But because we did talk about a lot of these things, and because I know for a fact that a lot of soldiers have a hard time talking about that stuff that they carry around with them, I do want you to talk about what can a soldier who's carrying some of this stuff around with him and is tired of doing that and wants to do something about it, what can they do? Where can they go? What is the process? What are the options available to them that can help them do that?
You don't have to come see me. I'd be happy to see you. And anyone who works with veterans, you could go to the VA. You can do anything from just sit down and have a cup of coffee with some like-minded people who are sitting and waiting for their appointments. Or you could get some very serious therapy. I say this all the time. There's no medal for going through this alone. If you can just get a friend, if you're at a low point in your life, you just grab somebody who's nearby and say, "Hey man, this is a little tough." Maybe they'll listen, and maybe that's what you need to get up and keep moving again. If it's not, maybe somebody closer. If that's not enough, give the VA a chance, give a therapist a chance. Give group a chance. I think vets don't like group. I'm glad you plugged group. I hope you had an excellent experience. Group is out of this world. And I think a lot of vets are going, I don't want to air my laundry. I don't want to be the center of attention. I don't want other people, blah, 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 whatever your reason for not wanting to go, try a group. You would be surprised at how many times you can just sit in the back and say, I'm not going to share anything. And the person next to you says exactly what you're going through. And you're going, holy crap, maybe these people can get me. And before you know it, you're the most active person in the group. You're contributing, you're growing. There are some dynamics in group that I think can even be superior to individual psychotherapy. There are meds. I don't want to crap on meds. I'm not the biggest supporter of medication, especially if it's the only treatment, because it does not cure anything. It just reduces symptoms. I personally will not refer for meds without a plan to get off them. What would it look like for you to not need them anymore? What would it look like to cut back, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? And that way they're still working on changing their outlook, changing their lifestyle, getting out and doing things. Just if you feel your world is small, that is the sign that you're not living fully, and come to me. I'll help you live fully.
Hell yeah, man. I like that stance on drugs too. I tell people all the time, drugs are not the show. They're the intermission. You just, sometimes if you're going to go on them, it's because it's too much to handle right now. And you just need a little break. You need a little dulling of that suffering or that pain or that whatever it is, so that you can look at it, but you can't stay there. And I'm glad that you have a responsible take on that, because there's a lot of people calling themselves doctors out there who just are prescription writers, and I'm glad you're not one of them. So props to you for that, Doc. Now, I think we're doing pretty good here. So there's just a couple things I like to do at the end of the podcast to kind of close it up. And this is a little bit differently, or this podcast has gone a little differently than just sort of my normal sort of open discussion, although we've been pretty free anyway. But let's take it away from just the emphasis on soldiers right now and remember that we have an audience who's listening. And so for the audience that's listening, if there was, or what is one question that you think they should ask of themselves, and what's one question you think they should ask of other people? Could be related to the conversation, or could be something totally different, but one question for themselves and one question for other people.
I think the most important question we should ask ourselves is, what are my values, or what do I value? Because I can't tell you what you should value any more than you can tell me what my favorite color is. It's green. No, you don't get to do that. A lot of times we don't know what really pumps us up, what we really value. Maybe we're going through the flow, or somebody else has told us what's important. You need to get a wife. You need to get a job. You need to have a house. And then you get all those things and you go, well, I might still feel as miserable as later, or as I did before. Ask yourself, what do I value? What is important to me? And when you know what that is, relentlessly pursue it. If you don't know where it is, or you're having a hard time finding it, look for where you hurt. Look for your pain. Your pain, the pain and your values are two sides of the same coin. If you can say, a veteran or otherwise, this bad thing that happened to me really hurts. Well, why does it hurt? What is it that you weren't getting, or what was it that was blocked or taken from you? That, well, guess what? That's something you value. That's something that's important. Once you know what that is, go after it. Don't hide. Go after what that's important. Because if if it's family, we talked about being a parent. You know, people don't want to be a dad. They want to be a good dad. If that's what you value, spend time with your kids. Do meaningful activity with your kids. You can be broke. You can be you could have shabby clothes or a job you hate. But you know that when you get out, you're going to spend time with your kids, and you can be happier than millionaires. I'd offer that same question to others. You know, if you're going to ask that question, or ask a question to somebody else, maybe it's a stranger, maybe you're striking up conversation, ask them that. What pumps you up? What fills your cup? What brings you joy? It's open-ended. And you ever talk with somebody who's talking about the things that they're passionate about? They light up. Oh my gosh, they light up. They could be talking about the most boring thing in the world. They can be talking about balancing a budget is the most boring thing to me. But if I spoke to somebody who's really passionate about it, like, oh my gosh, I helped this guy, really balance his checkbook. And oh, it was crazy. Like, if they're animated enough, I'm engaged. I'm like, yeah, tell me about the debits. I normally hate this. Ask somebody what they're passionate about. Let them light up. They're going to like you for it, and you're going to like them for it.
Man, I love that. And I couldn't agree more. And I think everybody out there who just heard you say that has experienced that, where somebody talks about something that maybe you don't have any interest into it, but they're so into it that their passion infects you. And maybe you don't walk away from the conversation going, man, I love personal finance. But uh-huh. You go, I like that dude because he's got some passion and he's able to share it with me. And that was a great exchange. And it's an important point to know that you can facilitate those exchanges by doing exactly what you just said, which is, hey man, what gets you fired up? And it might not be that so obvious. People sometimes are guarded, but if you can lead them into talking about the things that are important to them and get them to ignite that passion, they're going to remember that you did that too. And that's a great way to build, or to start building, or to continue to build a relationship. So I appreciate that advice, and I hope people will take that to heart. So look, man, this has been a conversation that touches on a lot of stuff that people are not necessarily going to be that comfortable with, but I think we did a pretty good job of humanizing a lot of it and making, you know, or giving people the opportunity to understand that a person's just a person no matter what they've done. And you might not agree with it. They might not agree with it, but I think we all deserve the chance to be the best person we can be today and to give other people the opportunity to do the same. And I hope that's what this conversation, I hope that's a takeaway that people have from this conversation, because that's really what I was hoping for. And I think you did a great job of doing that. So I want to thank you for taking the time to come on the podcast. And why don't you tell the people where they can find you if they want to check you out more or hit you up, or, you know, if somebody wants to reach out, how can they do that? That kind of thing.
Sure. Well, you know, I'm not looking for clients at the moment. I'm very satisfied with my individual therapy caseload. My passion is group. I love doing it. Well, those are full too. Sorry. So if you want to find anything that I have to say, look on Twitter. That's my opportunity to share my love for mental health and transformation to an open audience. I don't represent anybody on Twitter. I just want to talk about how cool the mind is and what we go through. My handle is Odysseus. It's like our the hero of the Odyssey, Odysseus, but with an E, Ed. Check me out. Hopefully you like my stuff. Hopefully I don't bore you.
I doubt you will. You got great content on there. That's how I discovered you. And here you are thrilling us all with this conversation. So, check out Doc Ed on Twitter, Odysseus. If you're good, I'm good, my friend.
Yeah, I'm good. Thank you for inviting me on here.
Oh man, it's been a pleasure. I really appreciate you doing it. And with that, this has been the Logo Centrifugal podcast. I've been Chance Lunsford. He's been Dr. Ed Perrin. And this has all been allegedly, and we're out.